It's an election season, and that means more ads on TV and radio and in your mailbox. But how many choices do you really have? I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk with a panel of guests about the rise of independent voters and what it may take to get them to vote, especially in the primary, where many legislative and congressional races are decided. Plus, Maricopa County seems to be on the right track to cleaning up the air. I'll talk with Eric Massey, director of the state's Air Quality Division, about where progress is being made and what still needs to be done. Also, a new development at 3rd Avenue and Camelback on the light rail line is attracting a lot of attention. It's called The Newton and features Changing Hands Bookstore and a new restaurant. Is it part of a trend, and will opening in the summer pose a challenge? We'll find out. And filmmaker Kevin Smith will be in Phoenix this weekend. We'll talk about his career and why he loves podcasting. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, is air quality in Arizona improving? The EPA has approved a Maricopa County plan for reducing dust particulates, which is considered a big step. I'll talk with the director of air quality for the state. Also, there's a new development called The Newton at 3rd Avenue and Camelback that's been drawing a lot of attention for its combination of tenants and its place along the light rail line. We'll find out more. Plus, why is the number of independent voters in Arizona climbing, and what will get more of them to vote in the primary, when a lot of the state's elections will really be decided? We'll hear from a panel that took part in an O'Connor House discussion last night. We start today's program with an update on a company that many in the economic development sector believe could have a huge impact in Arizona. The company is electric car maker Tesla. Ryan Randazzo of the Arizona Republic has been following the story closely and joins me now. Ryan, good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
So there'd been expectations Tesla would decide this month on where to put its new battery factory, but that's changed. So what's the latest?
Well, they said yesterday, the CEO, Elon Musk, told shareholders in California that he doesn't expect a decision on the primary site for that giant factory before the end of the year. So we were expecting something this month, and that apparently has been delayed.
How much competition is Arizona facing outside of the state, and how many cities actually in the state are competing with each other for this factory?
Well, it's difficult to tell how many sites are in the state are in the running, but it's likely probably just one. There's intense competition in the four or five states that are competing for the factory. That's Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, Arizona, and potentially California as a long shot to keep that company in state. But there's been just a ton of secrecy regarding how many sites are in each state and what those sites are specifically.
When you mentioned secrecy, this might make this question moot, but has Tesla given any indication about where it's leaning, what it's looking for, what qualities it wants?
Well, they want access to transportation by rail and highway. Some people have interpreted that to mean they're not quite sure how they want to ship the batteries they would make at this factory to their car factory in California. But I'm not positive that's the right thing to infer from that. Otherwise, no. They gave a very broad statement that they were looking at four states and did not give specifics regarding where they're at in those states. But development officials have hinted that there's some strong candidates. And there have been cities such as Gilbert that say they're not in the running. So you can, by process of elimination, sort of figure out where they're looking. In Arizona, it looks like probably a site in Pinal County and one in the West Valley area, maybe Buckeye.
Ryan, what's the level of economic impact and job creation that at least is being talked about for whatever community wins this factory?
Well, 6,500 jobs would be immense. The capital investment for this project is somewhere greater than $4 billion. So it would take quite a few people, obviously, just to build this factory, let alone the 6,500 who would work there. It would be huge. It would immediately jump to one of the largest employers in the state.
And Ryan, one more thing. Does everyone seem to be on board with this? Are there any skeptics about not necessarily the impact that Tesla could have, but perhaps its long-term viability as a company?
Well, what Tesla is doing hasn't been done since the 50s. They're essentially starting a new car company, and they have very small production today, and they want to get to the point where they're competing with other automakers. So that's a huge task. There definitely are skeptics that can be done, especially because they're electric cars. But so far, Tesla's problem hasn't been selling their vehicles. They're constrained by how many they can actually make, and they're constrained by batteries. So they have a different problem than other automakers. They're not out having a hard time selling the cars. They just can't make enough to meet demand. And whether or not they're going to be able to pull off this factory, certainly there's some doubters, but they gave a very optimistic outlook to their shareholders yesterday.
And as far as the brand name aspect of this thing, and this is why I asked the prior question, this idea of you're in a situation where there was Google, there's Apple. So now with Tesla involved, is this a case where it does seem like people are sort of chasing a unicorn in a sense?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. But, of course, Arizona did land a facility for Apple. We've lost some big projects, and we've had some projects materialize in our state that didn't pan out to be as big and great as we thought they were going to be, or as great as they were projected to be. But Tesla just has a crazy fanatical following, and I don't think that's an overstatement when you talk to the people who buy shares in the company and buy their cars. So, if you're asking me whether or not this will really happen, that's difficult for me to opinionate on. But I think there is some concern that we might offer a lot to this company, and it may not be as big of a project, or may not happen at all.
Ryan Randazzo of the Arizona Republic. You can follow him on Twitter at Utility Reporter. Ryan, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Air quality in the valley, at least according to the Environmental Protection Agency, is improving. The agency has approved a long-awaited clean air plan for Maricopa County. That means state and valley leaders no longer face the potential loss of billions of dollars in federal highway construction funds. So what happened and what more is being done? To talk about that, I'm joined by Eric Massey, Air Quality Division Director at the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. Eric, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So it seems like a big deal. How big is it?
This is a very big deal for the Phoenix area. We have been struggling with dust and dust pollution here since the dawn of Phoenix, but under the Modern Clean Air Act since the 1970s. So this is a very big moment for us.
So what made it happen?
So there's a lot of things that can be attributed to it, but the number one piece that made all of this happen is really partnership, and partnership that happened at a state level, a local level, with regulated entities coming to the table to find common solutions to common problems. And we were able to even invite EPA to that table.
We've heard about the stakeholders when it comes to air quality in Arizona, and there are challenges involved in that. So when you finally do get the stakeholders to the table, what are the issues you're discussing, and how much incremental give and take does there have to be?
There needs to be quite a bit of incremental give and take through all issues, right? What we may think might be a best practice across someplace else in the country may not be a feasible solution here for Arizona, either due to costs or things like water availability. One of the best ways of keeping dust down is to water it. Well, water's kind of a precious resource here.
Let's think about overall with air quality. We, obviously living in the valley, think a lot about the impact of Maricopa County, and the EPA was focused on Maricopa County as well. How much of what goes on with air quality when it relates to challenges or getting better really has to be focused on this area? Are we skipping out? Should we be focusing on Pinal County as well, and what goes on in Pima County, for example?
You know, it's a fantastic question. And so ADEQ's perspective has to look at the entire state. We spend a lot of time talking about Maricopa County because that's where our largest population is. About 80% of our population lives here. It's the greatest exposure. But we do have other air quality challenges. You've named Pinal County. We're currently working on plans to reduce dust in that particular area. Yuma's had previous problems. Other parts of the state have had problems with dust, and it is a regional issue, so it is something we look at.
So let's talk a little bit more. You mentioned water and keeping dust down. What are some of the things that have happened in the last few years? There had been a concern in Maricopa County that there were fewer air quality inspectors, for example. What do we do in a situation where there have been budget challenges in the state? How do you make improvements when there may not be funds to help make those improvements?
You know, it's a great question. And one of the best ways of getting improvements without having to regulatorily force it is to get your stakeholders involved in the group. So when we talk about partnership, compliance is key. And you know, when you're talking about an inspector, you're talking about an enforcement action, you're usually looking at something that's already occurred that's been negative to the environment. But if you get your stakeholders involved and get them upfront compliance, then you don't have enforcement issues and the inspections aren't as important.
So how big a deal is dust? When we think about air pollution in other places, perhaps it has more to do with factories, for example.
You know, dust is has many sources here. And so you can think about it from just driving on unpaved roads where we're not dealing with a regulated source. The actual desert itself will continue to blow just through monsoon storms. We've seen those giant dust storms come through Phoenix, things that are beyond our control. There are industrial sources. So rock products industry does quite a bit of effort and has some of the most stringent controls in the country. Same thing for home building. In an effort to make sure that the dust from all of these different sectors is accounted for.
You talked about not having control over the dust storms, and that was a dispute for a while, may it still in fact be with EPA in terms of those events that we have control over or not, especially in the case of those enormous haboobs, not just our average monsoon.
You're right. And so one of the points of contention back in 2010 when EPA proposed to disapprove this same kind of plan was this idea that exceptional events or these giant dust storms are something that we should be able to control. And what it came down to is bringing EPA to the table and understanding what their concerns with our technical analyses were and fixing those concerns. And it really helped that we saw some of these national stories pop up July 5th of 2011. I mean, my father was out of the country talking to me about, hey, is the pool okay? And EPA was like, is the world okay? It looks like the apocalypse happened. So some of those kinds of things have really helped bring that to the national attention and understand that there are some natural phenomenon that really cannot be controlled through better controls here in the Phoenix area.
Coming back specifically to Maricopa County and the EPA, what does it mean to eventually reach attainment status with the EPA? That's a fairly technical term, isn't it?
It's a very technical term. So what does that mean for the average person? Well, it means that we've achieved compliance with EPA's health-based standards, which is really important. The reality of it is that there are some things that we've been able to exempt from having to do additional controls for. And so some of the things that we're trying to do now is not ignore that particular segment. So we had 25 exceptional events over a three-year period. How do we help people protect those? How do we make sure that we're doing everything that we can to prevent our own contribution to those particular issues? So ADEQ puts out a forecast. Our partners at Maricopa County make sure that that's available through things like their Clean Air Make More application for smartphones, other places, so that we can put information not only to our regulated community to say, is there more that you could be doing to control your dust, but also to the public to say, much like you're preparing for a rainstorm, bring an umbrella, hey, Thursday's going to be a bad air quality day. Maybe you should think about not doing some of the exercises you usually do or change your activities so that you can protect your health.
I know there are people listening to us right now, though, who say, well, that's great that Maricopa County and the EPA are getting along, but I still see dirty air. I'm still worried about the monsoon or when our brown cloud arrives in the winter. So what other improvements are possibly going to take place? What are you still working on?
So here in the Phoenix area, when we talk about attainment, it's actually just the beginning of the story, right? So when you go to the gym, you have an idea that you're going to be working out or maybe you're going to go train for this marathon. We're now ready for the marathon. We have 20 years or more of time where we're going to have to continue the same level of effort that got us to this, right? So it's not like we can just say, okay, we're done and everybody go back to the way we used to be. We're going to have to maintain our efforts for this long period of time.
Eric, my final question, I saved a big one for last. Obama administration made a big announcement about reducing carbon emissions, and part of that is giving states the option of deciding for themselves how they're going to take this to reduce it by between 20% and 30%. Without getting into the politics of it, what are some of the challenges of that, or what are some ideas Arizona should consider?
Sure. So Arizona's actually got some real significant challenges because without getting into the politics of the issue, EPA did set state-specific goals. The state-specific goal for Arizona is actually worse than the 20 to 30% that they're looking at a national average. We're looking at almost a 50% reduction in what they call carbon intensity, the amount of carbon that we emit per unit of energy that we're developing and addressing. So we have a very significant challenge there. If you look at our energy source mix in the today, we are pretty heavily dominated by carbon-intense types of utilities and power generation. So what we're going to be needing to do, and what we as an agency are working towards, is a two-pronged approach. One, we're going to be considering our legal options on these particular issues. But in the same time, we have such a short time period to actually come up with a plan that we want to work together with our stakeholders and find that same level of partnership again with EPA, our stakeholders, and all of the affected communities to figure out what's the best path forward for Arizona, and if we can't achieve that goal, what else could we achieve in the interim?
That's Eric Massey, Air Quality Division Director at the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. Eric, thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll visit with the O'Connor House. There was a big discussion last night about many of the 2014 election issues, and you'll hear a sample just around the corner.
KJZZ is supported by APS. Next for APS means putting our state's most abundant natural resource to work by harnessing solar energy during the day to power Arizona at night. APS.com/next. The future of energy is bright.
Good morning. This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Checking temperatures around the state right now. Sunny and 74 degrees in Flagstaff. It's 84 and sunny in Prescott. Sunny skies and 99 degrees in Casa Grande. Sunny and 98 in Tucson. Sunny and 99 in Yuma. A special thank you to our Leadership Society members, Dr. and Mrs. William Wachter, for their generous support in bringing programs like Here and Now and All Things Considered to KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8444. It's 1120 at KJZZ.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Last night, in collaboration with the O'Connor House, KJZZ hosted a panel discussion on some of the big issues of the 2014 election season. They included voter turnout, the growing power of independent voters, the impact of primary elections, and dark money and independent expenditure groups. The panelists were Chris Hurstam, Joe Canefield, Karen Osborne, and Tom Ryan. Right now, we're presenting an edited version of last night's discussion. We start with Karen Osborne commenting on the continued growth of Arizonans who register as independents.
It's absolutely picking up more and more. Every month we get a report of people changing parties. And 15, 20 years ago, it was the same amount of Democrats would change to be Republicans and vice versa. A few changed to be Libertarian. And now it is not changing to the major parties. It is coming away from that and coming into the independent. Even in the, we have, right now we have 1,975,000 people registered in Maricopa County, just by itself. We'll hit 2 million before we come to probably the primary, but most certainly the general. And of that, the largest group is the independent. Passed the Democrats quite a while ago and then passed the Republicans. So it continues to build and build and build every month, every week.
I just want to say something briefly about being an independent and what I'm looking for. And that is this. When is the last time you looked at a race in the state of Arizona and you thought to yourself, two excellent candidates going up against each other, having a real debate about the issues that matter to Arizona? Yeah, I hear some laughter. You have to go back a long, long time. And that's not a good statement. Arizona used to be a state where we looked to our politicians. The nation did, not just us, the nation used to look to Barry Goldwater, to John Rhodes. You know, when Nixon had to decide whether or not to resign or not, they looked to our politicians to understand what the risk was here. Now we're a laughing stock. Our marketing value, our brand value has shrunk. You know, there was a time we passed a groundwater code. It's time to be revisited again. Does anybody really have the confidence? And I apologize to any of the legislative or leaders that are here, but quite frankly, I don't have the confidence right now that we have the legislative leadership to address an issue of that magnitude. And we need to get back there again.
I wanted to make the point before we get off the topic of independence. The numbers are staggering, what's happened in the last 15 years and the dramatic increase in registered independents. And all you have to do is look at where that trend is going to go. Today, 35% of the registered voters are independent. And when you round them off, 35% are Republican and 30% are Democrats. But when you look at the 18 to 34-year-olds, up to 34, the future, in other words. Right now in Arizona, 48% of that group is registered independents. And the two parties are tied at 26 each. You can see the handwriting on the wall. What's going to happen down the road, 10 to 15 years from now, almost 50% of our registered voters in this state are going to be independents. But there's a horrible problem, and that is those registered independents, unless they're filthy rich, they cannot successfully run for office. If we don't create a level playing field for independents to run for office, we're someday going to have 45 to 50% of our registered voters just cut out of the candidate process, and the quality of our candidates will go down appreciably.
One of the complications, though, Chris, and I think Tom, I'll turn to you on this. Even as we see this growing number of independents, though,
I will make the comparison to the Latino vote that we've heard a lot about, and this idea that Latino voters are not a monolith any more than independent voters are. So as people become independent, they're not forming an independent party, though, and that must complicate things.
No, that does, and I think that's an excellent point. In politics, we tend to break society up into groups and treat them all as monolithics in their thinking. We do that with women, for example, but the idea that Mother Teresa and Madonna looked at life exactly the same way is obviously belied by who they were and what they did. But we do that. We tend to look at things very, very monolithically. If you're Latino, you must be Democrat. Well, there are Republican, conservative Latinos and Latinas out there, as there are people who are social justice Latinos out there as well that are Democrats. So the plain fact of the matter is, no, independents are not monolithic, and you will not see an independent party arise. That doesn't mean they don't have clout, and it doesn't mean they won't figure out a way to exercise the power. I think there are laws that need to be changed that will empower the independent vote. And I do think that once that happens, it will keep the two parties from just playing to their base and now bring it more towards a moderate point of view. I think that would be good for the state of Arizona.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Right now we're presenting an edited version of a panel discussion that took place last night in collaboration with the O'Connor House. We talked about some big issues, including voter turnout, independent voters, and the impact of primary elections. We continued the discussion with Chris Hurstam, talking about whether an open primary system would be an improvement for Arizona and help attract better candidates.
Well, the biggest knock, I think, on the top two primary, which is really an open nonpartisan primary, is that, oh my gosh, you could end up with two Democrats or two Republicans in a general election. Well, in 25 of the 30 legislative districts, it's not competitive anyway. Whoever wins the primary is in. What you'd end up with, let's say you ended up with two Republicans in the general election for governor. Guess what? For one of those persons to win, one of those Republicans to win, they're going to have to get the Democratic and the independent vote to win. They're going to have to move to the center on issues. The top two primary will, in my opinion, produce candidates that move more to the center, are more centrist, less ideological, and more problem-solving oriented. I think that it's in California right now. It was enacted there a couple of years ago, and some of the articles that I've been reading show that it's already working. That even if you end up with two from the same party in the general election, they tend to move to the center, and they will be more moderates elected to the legislative bodies.
Just to balance things out, we've heard some great advocacy from Chris on the top two system, but as I recall, Chris, you may want to address this, so there certainly was a campaign, and we use the term dark money, which really means just anonymous money from contributors that don't wish to be disclosed. But there was also some concern about that system from other groups, some smaller groups, smaller political parties like the Libertarians were concerned that they'd get boxed out in that system. But if I recall, the minority groups were opposed, and it was an odd coalition of sorts that showed up at the Capitol to oppose it. So, I don't want everyone leaving here. I'm just thinking that is the answer to all of our problems, because there certainly was groups that did not feel that system would be beneficial to them.
Sure, both political parties opposed it. Major portions of the business community were opposed to it. Unfortunately, I think the Latino community was asked to oppose it because they will have a growing demographic impact on elections down the road and within the Democratic Party, so maybe we ought to hang on to this system and use the Democratic Party, and we'll have more clout that way. I'm just saying that down the road, whether it's left or right, you need more problem solving, less ideology, and the top two primary gives you that.
In so many of these races, in part because of gerrymandering, in part because of redistricting, to put it a nicer way, many of these races are going to be decided in the primary. We're not just talking about legislative races. I don't have the form in front of me, but I'm not sure the Democrats are running a state treasurer candidate.
Right. The idea of clean elections was to give both parties, and beyond just both parties, all candidates, an opportunity to have a candidate in all elections. That has never happened, even with clean elections. You would think that you can go out in a non-competitive district, get your money, and then run, and hopefully with the competition of ideas that you're ultimately going to get elected, even if you're a D in an R district. The plain fact of the matter is, the way the districts are set up, they're non-competitive, most of them. There is some, we have to pay attention to the idea of not creating districts that disenfranchise important subgroups within our state. That's very important to pay attention to. But we've paid more attention to the political process than we have the subgroups. And as a result, we end up with a congressional district where only a Democrat will ever win, and congressional districts where only Republicans will ever win, and the same with our legislative districts. I don't see that as healthy because it doesn't force the competition of ideas. We don't have the marketplace of political ideas when we have non-competitive districts like that.
Karen, this sort of brings us back to turnout again.
It always comes back to turnout. But I think we need to think a little bit outside the box of just Arizona. In Arizona, we have a presidential preference election. You can only vote in the presidential preference election if you are registered in the Republican Party, you vote in the Republican Party. If you're registered in the Democratic Party, you vote. Whoever brings those candidates forward. And ever so many times, by the time we get to that election, most of those candidates have pulled out. And I think that goes to the earlier question about how do we get people to continue to be engaged? Is that something that the political parties want to do on their own? Do they still want to have the have governments send the ballot? That's an open for discussion question, and that's going to be coming up in 2016.
Joe, as someone who's been involved with representing the IRC, competitiveness was certainly one of the criterion used there. What are your thoughts in general about the effect of redistricting, the effect overall on primary turnout, and the fact that so many of the elections are decided long before November? And of course, in Arizona, we joked about the hot weather when we started this. A lot of people are not going to be here in August when the primary takes place.
I absolutely think there's a connection between the districting process and voter turnout. I mean, for a lot of the reasons we've already discussed it, because so many of the districts are one party dominant, it's going to mean that a lot of voters are just going to decide to stay at home rather than vote because they don't think their vote is really going to count. But something to think about too, yes, competitiveness is a factor, one of six factors that the Independent Redistricting Commission has to take into consideration when it draws our congressional legislative districts. But the number one and number two factors are complying with the United States Constitution and the Voting Rights Act. The United States Constitution says that all the districts have to be equal population. So there's one issue, right? You've got the legislative districts are about 210,000 voters and congressional districts are just south of 800,000. So that in itself, you know, just given the way that people cluster together in the state, you know, is going to lend itself to drawing districts in a way that are going to often mean people of like mind are going to be together. The other issue with the Voting Rights Act is that this dates back to 1965. It's a federal law that says that no state shall discriminate against minority groups, people, certain races, color, in any kind of voting decision. So that, and what that effectively means is that certain groups, minority groups, especially in Arizona, we talk about Hispanic voters, bilingual speaking voters, and Native American voters, that they cannot be diluted in any way. They've got, those voters have to be kept together. If they're not, then that will bring a lawsuit, invite a lawsuit for violation of the Voting Rights Act. But when you take all that into consideration, contiguousness, you know, the districts have to be together, you're supposed to respect city and county boundaries, all these other things before you get to competitiveness. It's very hard at that point, once you comply with all the other criteria, to try to then make districts competitive in terms of voter registration and party registration.
And that was just part of our discussion from last night in collaboration with the O'Connor House, the Issues and Answers Forum. It featured Chris Hurstam, Joe Canefield, Karen Osborne, and Tom Ryan. If you'd like to hear the entire version, you can find it online at kjzz.org. Still to come on Here and Now, we'll be talking about The Newton. It's a new development at 3rd Avenue in Camelback featuring Changing Hands Bookstore and a restaurant and some other things. We'll talk about the effect on transit-oriented development. That's coming up as Here and Now continues.
KJZZ is supported by El Charro, Paradise Valley's oasis from the summer heat, offering refreshing summer cocktails and seasonal cuisine created from organic, locally grown ingredients. Menus and more at elchorro.com.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM. Valley forecast calling for a high today of 110 degrees, and we have an excessive heat warning in effect until 8 o'clock Thursday night. Coming up in about 25 minutes, we'll have NPR's Here and Now. We'll hear about a hard-fought GOP Senate primary race in Mississippi that may be headed for a runoff. And resident chef Kathy Gunst shares how she feels about lettuce. NPR's Here and Now from Boston starts at noon. In Valley traffic, watch out for a crash on the surface streets at 96th Street and Thunderbird. It's mostly sunny in Phoenix and 99 degrees at 11:36.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Since the Valley's light rail line became established, supporters have passionately opined that transit-oriented development would have a positive impact on the area's economy. Parts of Phoenix and Mesa have seen those results. Now, as of last weekend at 3rd Avenue and Camelback, a new combination of Changing Hands Bookstore and the Southern Rail Restaurant from award-winning local chef Justin Beckett is ready to take that impact to another level. Lorenzo Perez is co-owner of Phoenix-based Venue Projects, which developed the Newton, and he joins me now. People have probably heard a lot about Changing Hands. They've also heard about Justin Beckett's new restaurant. Why are those exciting sort of foundations for the Newton, and what else is in the mix?
Well, I think what's exciting about Changing Hands is they're iconic. They just celebrated 40 years in the Valley, and I'm a native, and if you've grown up here, you remember them on Mill, you remember them in South Tempe, and so to get an opportunity to bring them into Central Phoenix was exciting, and to put them in an iconic building like the old Beefeater was an amazing opportunity. I really got to credit my business partner for that one, John Kitchell. He's the one who said, could you imagine if we put Changing Hands in the old Beefeater? What would that look like? And that's where it all started.
Can you describe that space? Because there are some people, I mean, I've been to Beefeaters as someone who grew up here, but a lot of people haven't. It's 3rd Avenue and Camelback, but what did it look like before you guys got your hands on it, or what does it look like now?
The condition we got it in, if you've ever watched the movie The Blair Witch Project, Justin Beckett used to joke about it as we'd walk through it. It was pretty tired, and unfortunately had been vandalized and picked apart, and the inside was
How long had it been closed?
I believe since 2006. Okay. But we got involved with this project 2010. We were introduced to the former owner, a lady from San Francisco. She's an investor, bought it as part of a vision for a much bigger project. We all know what happened with the recession, and she was sitting there going, I don't know what to do with this. Somehow, some way, through, I think, a city planner, she made contact with us and asked us if we'd be willing to meet with her and do some visioning and creative planning. And it was through that process, it was basically an extended due diligence process where we went through and analyzed the building. We walked away from it pretty surprised. One, the community was really outspoken about wanting to save it. They mentioned in some community outreach charrettes that they wanted a place that was for the community, a gathering space, if you will. And the third thing was the city wanted it. They viewed it as, back then it was Councilman Simplot, was pretty vocal in terms of how important it was. And there was this nostalgia around it that was really cool. I grew up at 19th Avenue in Camelback area, went to Central High. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, in the 70s and 80s, was always going by it and always knew what a big deal it was. And we got to go there once in a while on the very rare, you know, big occasion.
Right.
It was just really interesting.
What does it look like now? What are some things that will make this place stand out? What are some elements you've kept from the old Beefeater restaurant?
Sure. So we kept the entire original core mid-century building, and it really does. We really put a lot of thought and attention into preserving sort of what we call the soul and essence of what the Beefeater was. And we really wanted to express what was interesting about the Beefeater is that it was this design disconnect. You had these mid-century lines, and then you had this, on the interior, this old English interior design scheme. I think what was interesting about the Beefeaters, it was very intro-focused, meaning you didn't really know what was going on inside from the outside. And when you're inside, you really had very little connection to the outside. So we told people, listen, our objective is a modern-day reinterpretation of what the Beefeater once was, which is a community gathering space centered around food and gatherings. But we needed to make it work for today's world. And today's world really appreciates that indoor-outdoor connection. We really wanted to celebrate the beauty of the space, and we wanted people, whether they're traveling on the light rail, on Camelback, as they're walking in, that there was no guessing that it was a people place. We pushed the restaurant out on Camelback. We removed some old additions that were added in the 80s and 70s. They really kind of hid the original spirit of the building. And we became aware of what the original building looked like from an old photo that the Arizona Contractors Association shared with us that showed that sawtooth roof line. And we all got excited. We just thought, if we can pull those off and extend that look out to Camelback and really floor to ceiling, look inside, you know, we really thought we'd have a dynamic space.
So an iconic spot, as you mentioned,
yes.
3rd Avenue and Camelback. Based on the recession, based on some other things, I don't think that's been considered a real hot area.
No.
Why do you have hope going forward, and how much of that has to do with TOD, transit-oriented development?
You know, that area really got impacted in a negative way. It seemed to be like one of the last areas along the TOD. Here you are at Central and Camelback, but you're west of Central, and us old Phoenicians know the stigma of west of Central and the avenues. I think that's partly part of it. I think what's interesting about this, the Beefeater sort of sits at 3rd Avenue, and it's right between Central, right between 7th Avenue. I think what, you know, Councilman Simplot and Pastor's office expressed to us is that if we had a project that was community-focused, that preserved sort of the scale and the vibe of old Phoenix, it could be catalytic in terms of stimulating reinvestment, rehabilitation of neighboring businesses, its proximity to the light rail station. There's just a lot going on there that excited us. Not only did it have a unique architecture, it had a story, it had unique context, being next to some really cool historic neighborhoods in Medlock Place, Pearson Place. So all of it came together, and to us it was just this grand opportunity to do something exciting and creative there.
From now on, so we had the opening of Changing Hands, we had the opening of Southern Rail, which
Correct.
Is open for dinner now, eventually open for lunch soon.
Yes.
And what's your role from now on going forward?
So one of the unique things that we do is we invite our anchor tenants to be partners in the building. And so Changing Hands and Southern Rail are equity holders in the building with us. They each own a 20% share. So we are an active management group. So we'll be very involved in the day-to-day management. We have some big ideas and plans to really program and activate the space so that it stays dynamic and something that's interesting, doesn't become stagnant. So we have this common area. We were able to preserve the old banquet facility that a lot of stories, a lot of events happened in. Changing Hands will do a lot of events there. One of the things we tried to do in the design and programming of the project was create synergy amongst our tenant partners. And one of the things we do differently than a lot of commercial developers is we call it curating our tenants. We actually go out and look for and recruit a tenant. We don't go to open market and say, come to us. We really look to see who shares in the value, understands the mission of the project, and who's going to be a great fit, because we feel like together, if we can put the right mix together, the property's going to be just one dynamic experience.
I'm sure there are some people out there who are going to say, couldn't they have waited till September maybe, because summer in Phoenix can be tough.
Yes.
Is that a worry at all?
Yeah, we wanted to open last. I think originally we knew it, we voiced it, we owned it, that we had an aggressive schedule. We were going to try to open in November, and you know, once we peeled back the building, we discovered some structural items. We discovered that the building's roofing had leaked for 6 years, and so we had to remove the roof skin and really decided to take our time and make sure we did it right. We're long-term holders on the property. So it just fell where it fell. We tried to open in spring, and it, you know, one thing after another, the summer schedules of our team, of the city team, trying to get it permitted, people coming and going. So the project was just complicated, and it drug out a little bit longer. It is the summer, and obviously anyone who's in retail knows that summer there's a drop-off. I think we always try to find the silver lining. We knew there was a lot of anticipation from the community. As we saw last Friday night, we were completely overwhelmed with the support all weekend, continuing to see there. I think it'll be nice if things do kind of back off a little bit, so we can kind of refine and learn from this initial output and kind of get our feel for the property. Mm-hmm. There's this sort of growing in phase that we'll go through, and it'll allow us to refine and fine-tune it, if you will.
Lorenzo Perez, co-owner of Phoenix-based Venue Projects, which developed the Newton at 3rd Avenue in Camelback. Lorenzo, thank you.
Thank you.
The Newton is a hot project, one that's expected to do well, but are there ongoing challenges and potential pitfalls? Larry Ortega is executive vice president with Colliers International in Phoenix. He specializes in the sale and leasing of retail properties. What are your thoughts on the location of the Newton? What else is going on in that area and other areas of Central Phoenix we should be excited about?
The area is turning around, and especially with a project like the Newton, that's an anchor tenant to that block. I mean, that's a game changer. That is a whole community rolled up into one, and will change the complexion of that area.
Is there more promise and more hope for those smaller sort of multi-use or more retail-oriented areas? Is that something that, if that works, we could be seeing a lot more of that?
Yeah, I think what's going to happen is, which is happening, is there a return to local. And by that, I mean what we see like in the Central Phoenix area, the restaurants. We're not seeing a proliferation of chain restaurants. We're seeing chef-driven restaurants coming into the area, and that's unique and a great change. And so what's going to happen along Camelback is, additional buildings will be purchased and hopefully rehabbed and reused.
Mm-hmm. Larry, you've been in the Valley since 1980. A project that was a lot more recent than 1980 I wanted to ask you about that just came to mind for me. There was an area on Grant Street not that long ago that had a Poison Pen bookstore, Arcadia Farms, and an art gallery. We always hear location, location, location. The options that people had seem very similar to what we're hearing from the Newton. What is the difference between a really successful project and one that might not be as successful?
That project was really in the downtown area. ASU hadn't really been on board yet, and we didn't have a downtown. We didn't have a residential downtown. A little bit ahead of their time and some of those other factors.
So it's not just location, it's also timing. And how difficult is it to know when trends are going a certain way?
Boy, if I knew that. Well, we definitely can see the trends in central and downtown Phoenix. What's happening with everything from residential to the commercial market to the changing of culture downtown and what people are interested in. And to see now that we have all parts of the valley are, understanding that it's more than just, sports entertainment downtown. There's the cultural scene, which has been there for a long time, but is now kind of reawakening. And our art scene that, we always thought of Scottsdale as being the preeminent art center in the Phoenix Valley, that now downtown Phoenix is really starting to propel itself in that direction.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about transit-oriented development. That was something that some people were fairly cynical about, whether this could work in such a car culture like this. So how promising do you think that aspect is?
I was one of the cynical. I really was. Okay. I looked at it and said, the ridership will be this and that. And I'm wrong. I see now the benefit of being on light rail, including the development benefit. I mean, the perks that you get by being in that transit district is going to propel development. And we see it on Central Avenue. Buildings that are somewhat functionally obsolete, office buildings that are functionally obsolete, they're being purchased, they're going to be torn down, and residential will be replacing them. And we see a lot of that.
So we should expect that to be a growing trend because, again, there are people who are cynical about the idea of more people wanting to live in that downtown area, and yet we're seeing the density increasing, and we're seeing younger people going there, too.
We're seeing younger people, and we're also seeing people my age that are downsizing. I have one of my clients downsized from 9,000 square feet in Paradise Valley to about 1,400 feet.
When it comes to the transit-oriented development or Camelback Corridor, other areas of downtown and central Phoenix, how much of the growth and success is going to rely on people not just moving downtown, as you mentioned, your Paradise Valley client, but folks who want to come in from areas where people might have a little bit more spending money? How important is it that those people are drawn there as well? And how often do they have to be drawn there? Like, can it be once a week for a music show? Can it be once a week for a restaurant? Or do they have to come down more often than that?
One of the things that I've been noticing, and having worked in that central Phoenix market, it used to be, you know, they're from Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle. Oh, we want to be in downtown Tempe where it's hip and all that. Now we're seeing that trend is that where do you want to be? We want to be downtown. We want to be in downtown Phoenix and build that culture because it's still somewhat a frontier, and you can stake your claim out there. So that's an exciting aspect of downtown.
Larry, as we said, you've been here for more than 3 decades, and you've seen obviously trends. You've seen cycles up and down. What makes you optimistic that when it comes to transit-oriented development, people moving downtown, that's one where even if there's a bump, it won't be a real sustained bump?
I think what's happening now, you know, especially with education really leading the way in downtown Phoenix, is that we're diversifying. We're seeing now that the investment that the city made with biomedical, how that is paying off. You know, we see the U of A Cancer Center will be opening up very soon, and we'll see the announcement of their R&D facility. Those are our major projects. And so as we diversify and we're not locked into that real estate industry or the other ones that have, you know, caused severe valleys and mountains, that those things should flatten out. You know, I think that's going to be the trend in the future as well.
Larry Ortega is Executive Vice President with Colliers International, who specializes in the sale and leasing of retail properties. Larry, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The filmmaker Kevin Smith is probably best known for his films Clerks and Chasing Amy, but Smith is also actively involved in other realms of pop culture, like comic books and podcasts. He'll be at Stand Up Live in downtown Phoenix on Saturday for a 7 p.m. live podcast called Jay and Silent Bob Get Old, featuring himself and one of the popular co-stars of Clerks. Smith joined me earlier by phone from Los Angeles. Kevin, obviously people know you for lots of different things, but the first thing I want to ask you about is how you've made this whole podcasting thing your own. I mean, you've made a real unique thing out of it.
Honestly, like, I just wanted to be you. Like, I go into radio all the time over the course of the last 20 years from Clerks forward. Anytime I go to promote something, I go into a radio station, and I was struck, thunderstruck constantly by the notion of, like, this is where I belong, because I got a body built for, you know, radio, man, telling stories and stuff like that. I'm not a very gifted visual stylist. When it comes to filmmaking, in terms of telling a story with pictures, it took me like 20 years to learn how to do it. If you look at the first few flicks I made, you know, they're amateurish as heck, because I didn't know how to tell you a story with pictures. I can do it with words. So I was always very attracted to radio, so much so that I was like, maybe if this film, I'd make enough money off this movie thing, I could buy the local radio station in New Jersey. I think it was The Rat, it was called.
So when you do it live like you're going to do here in Phoenix, what are your expectations for the audience? I mean, are you just sort of, you're there with the audience, but are you still doing your own thing? Or are you thinking about how they're reacting to you?
Oh, it's a different version of the show than you'll do at home. Like, for example, that night, I'm doing two shows in Phoenix at Stand Up Live. At 7 o'clock, I'm doing Jay and Silent Bob Get Old, which is a show I do with my friend Jason Mewes, who played Jay to my Silent Bob. And that's all about him getting clean, staying sober. Very funny show, but it's really like a funny AA meeting that takes place in a comedy club. That show has always pretty much been a live show. Every once in a while, we do it at home, but it's very rare, very rare. Edumacation, the show after I do that I'm doing that night afterwards, that's always a home show, and very rarely do we pop out and do a live show. So that's the one that's interesting to me, because the home show dynamic, you know, you can just roll. You're not worried about, they're laughing, they're not laughing, we got to move on. You can just sit there and stream of consciousness, and sometimes some of the stuff's not funny, but eventually you'll come around to something funny. Whereas when you've got the live audience right there, forget it. They'll let you know, if they're bored by what you're talking about and if you're not being funny enough. So it does shape the show a bit differently. But it's an interesting question, because it does change, like, the intimacy of the medium. You know, it would be like doing the radio show live. Like whenever you, if you take it live, it's completely different than when you're in the room, because suddenly you're vibing off the energy of other people sitting there listening.
Yeah, right. Do they look as fascinated as I want them to be right now? Maybe
exactly. Like, am I reaching them? Because in our heads, like I know when I'm home recording, I'm like, this is so fascinating. Everyone will be interested by it. And then you take it on the road, and you find out pretty quickly, like, we don't think that's funny, dude. Move on. You're like, all right.
Kevin, you've been famous for a long time, since you were a young guy. So what are the pluses and minuses of that?
I mean, honestly, there's never really been a minus. There was, the time I got kicked off the plane for being fat, that was a negative in as much as, like, hey, it's the clerk's guy. You know, if I was anonymous, it wouldn't have been a big deal. But even that I can't complain about, man. Like, there's really been no downside. Now, to be fair, I'm not really, like, famous like most of the people I know are famous. Like, Affleck, he's famous. And that, it's tough. You can't go out and get a coffee when you're that famous. Me, I can go to the mall and, like, maybe three people throughout the day will be like, hey, man, you look like that dude. Or be like, hey, man, you are that dude. But generally, it's a really nice level. Not the level where people walk up to you and, like, punch you in the face or something like that, because they're like, I can't stand seeing you all the time.
You mentioned Ben Affleck. You've also been writing comic books, creating comic books. Where does that come from for you? And is the passion of fans of comic books and those who are maybe not that excited about your friend being chosen to play Batman, is that the same sort of audience you're trying to hit with the podcast, with your movies, that sort of passionate audience that might drive you crazy sometimes, but you're happy they're passionate?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, all anybody needs is, somebody did a study recently. They said all you need is 1,000 supporters to make a living or something like that. You could do live shows, you can run ads or whatever. We've never been at a better time in media in general. The democratization of media is really in the hands of anybody that wants to step up to do it. YouTube kids, the podcasters, things that, like, back 20 years ago when I was, making Clerks, that stuff was a dream. It didn't really exist. It wasn't as viable as it is now. So now passion drives all these mediums. Like, that's the, my legacy is this. Clerks is a movie that people love to watch. Some people love to watch. But what you leave feeling that movie with is empowered. You're like, oh, man, if that counts, I can make a movie. So same thing here. You're like, that movie was made on passion more than talent. Same thing now with, like, the age of podcasting, the age of people creating their own entertainment online via YouTube or other mechanisms. It's suddenly like you get to a passionate place where you're like, look, nobody's going to pay me to do it. I'll just do it because I love it. And those people are turning that eventually into jobs. But it's the dream factory now, man, like more so than ever before. We used to have a generation of kids. Like, I was raised by parents that were like, go to college and get a good job because that's how you get the American dream. And now you've got the first generation of kids whose parents are literally telling them, just find out what you love and try to get paid to do that. There's no more of this, like, here's the easy formula, because we've turned the world into microcosms. You can sit there and deal with one microcosm. You don't have to go macro anymore. It's like, you don't have to win everybody with a Star Wars movie or a Batman movie. You can win just enough ardent people with a small, cool movie and stuff, or a small, cool website.
Kevin, I'll let you go with this. You've got two shows on Saturday night, Stand Up Live. But also this weekend, I don't know if you knew this, the Phoenix Comic Con is going on.
Heavens, yes.
Will people expecting to see you there or no?
Going in. I know Muse is going the next day, and I might actually go with him.
You might go with him, so you might not.
Might pop in as well, yeah. See, me at a Comic Con, like, I need to find a disguise, because that's the one place in the world. Like, I could go to a mall and stuff, maybe two or three people come up to you. If I was to go to a Comic Con, it's like the one place on Earth where, like in the Warner Brothers cartoons where the two dudes stuck on the desert island look at each other and one looks like chicken, one looks like steak or something. That's the one place in the world where I'm considered sexy, where there's almost no movement if I step onto that floor. So it would be best if I adopted costume, but I'm always afraid somebody would be like, I'm pretty sure that stormtrooper, the fat stormtrooper in the hockey jersey, might be Silent Bob.
Pop culture maven Kevin Smith will be in Phoenix on Saturday night for two shows, 7 and 10 at Stand Up Live. Kevin, thanks for the time.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on the program. Thank you for listening. If you missed any part of this program, any of our past editions, go online this afternoon to KJZZ.org. That's also where you'll find the entire Issues and Answers forum from last night in collaboration with the O'Connor House. Now we go to Boston for NPR's Here and Now on KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.